Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. A man I have come to admire greatly for his insights, his thoughtfulness, his expertise on matters involving the most serious threat to the country we love, namely the Chinese Communist Party, is our first guest. His name is Dr. Bradley Thayer. He is, among other things, a member of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, a very, very prolific contributor to the public policy debate, notably at The Hill newspaper and Epoch Times. He's the author of a number of books, including a very important one about Han supremacism, which I commend to you all. He is gracious with his time. We're always delighted to catch up with him. Brad, welcome back to Securing America.
Good morning, Frank. Thanks for having me.
The pleasure is mine. I'm anxious to talk with you about a couple of topics that tie the China threat into larger world geostrategic issues. Specifically, you've written recently about the entente, as you call it, between the Russians and the Chinese. It clearly was put into play formally shortly before the invasion by the Russians of Ukraine. Talk a little bit about the state of that entente as you see it at the moment, and whether net-net it's becoming more dangerous as a result of the reverses that the Russians have experienced to date.
Thank you, Frank. It's an excellent question and a very significant issue for the United States. The United States faces, of course, the threat of China, and China, of course, is a prodigious power and becoming more powerful in relative terms. The warming of the relationship between Moscow and Beijing certainly helps Beijing in that it gives the Chinese the ability to employ Russian assets, intelligence assets, military power, diplomatic influence, also ideological influence around the world. So the warming of this relationship is very bad for the United States. And as you noted, it was precipitated before the Ukraine war, but it has greatly increased.
Specifically, I assume the dependence on Russia for help from the Chinese in terms of buying oil and gas and perhaps other commodities. Let me ask you, though, about the visit to Ukraine, Brad, yesterday by the Secretaries of State and Defense of the United States, Tony Blinken and Lloyd Austin, respectively. And in particular, a comment made by Lloyd Austin on the margins of those conversations with President Zelensky of Ukraine, namely that I guess it's a goal, a policy of the United States government to seek the actual defeat of Russia in Ukraine. Your thoughts on that and how that might play into this Russian-Chinese dynamic?
Well, it plays very importantly into it. It's an unfortunate comment in the sense that it was made publicly. If that's U.S. strategy, of course, we shouldn't express it openly. Weakening Russia just ensures that they ever increasingly warm their relationship with China. And so there are only so many centers of power in international politics: the United States, Japan, South Korea, China, India, Europe, and Russia in a military sense, in terms of its military might and intelligence capabilities. Driving Russia towards China only helps China. We have, again, the very difficult task of focusing on the China threat, and anything that helps China hurts us in that supreme contest, which we are now fighting and that we will continue to fight for the rest of the century, very likely. And so moving Russia towards China is a strategic complication and indeed an error in terms of that. What we should be doing is our utmost to ensure that China does not have any allies, it does not have any support from any major power in international politics. And what we're witnessing is really the solidification of that relationship between Moscow and Beijing, which makes our already Herculean task of confronting China even more difficult.
Yes. I want to talk to you about the quality of leadership that may be contributing to this misapplication of strategy, if you will. You've written very interesting pieces recently about both our own leadership and its shortcomings, but also excellence in the leadership of the British military. Walk us through quickly what is needed at a moment like this, whether it's on the military side or the civilian side, as we're facing not one, but now two of these formidable adversaries.
Yeah, Frank, several elements are needed, but most importantly, it's an understanding of the tradition. It's an understanding of the inheritance that military officers have in terms of how the problems that we face today have been faced before by previous officers, and the lessons, the culture, the habits of excellence in particular, of ensuring that they make the what's necessary to ensure that the chain of command is respected, that the enlisted are respected as well, is supremely important for the combat effectiveness of the United States. The British Army has that tradition. The United States Army has that U.S. military has that tradition as well. But it's being eroded by ideological factors, as well as some other, but ideological factors are the most significant. So the U.S. military needs to recapture its heritage. It needs to recapture the value of its traditions, its culture, its language, even the recognition that it faces an enemy that has to be defeated is the most salient element there. And if we are able to inspire military officers once again, that only greatly is a major fill-up in our confrontation with the Chinese, the People's Liberation Army in particular, who do not have that tradition, which is an important asset for us as we move ahead.
Their tradition is one of a highly politicized military, I think it's fair to say, with the political commissars literally operating sort of a parallel chain of command. You said several things, though, that I want to just come back to quickly, Brad. We're going to have to take a break here in a moment. But what we are dealing with, it seems to me, is not nearly a need to have the military leadership be respected, but to be worthy of respect. And in part, that's a function, it seems to me, of the accommodations that the current military leadership has made to the ideological demands of this current administration, the Biden administration. And specifically, I'm thinking about this layering of politicized policies on the military, whether it's the critical race theory agenda, or whether it's the social experimentation or engineering agenda, whether it's the COVID vaccine mandates, for that matter, all of which have an impact, it seems to me, on the culture of the military. And I'm so glad you've emphasized that, Brad. Just give me a minute on that, because we have to take, as I say, a short break.
Certainly. A great political scientist, Samuel Huntington, wrote an incredible book, The Soldier and the State, where he made a very elegant, sophisticated argument that the United States military has to have its independent domain. The military has to be left to its own devices under civilian direction. It takes its orders from civilians, but then civilians stay out of it and allow the military to develop their own mechanisms, their own solutions. And we need to recapture that. As you noted, that's being eroded, and it's really a torrent.
I would argue that, yeah, it's actually under active assault, not just being eroded. It seems there's a sort of, I'd say, war on the U.S. military by the Biden team. Brad, hold the thought. We're going to come right back with more with Dr. Bradley Thayer right after this. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Last week, former President Barack Obama declared that government needs to start regulating free speech on social media platforms because their content management efforts are failing to keep rhetorical, quote, raw sewage out of the public square, unquote. This week, billionaire Elon Musk bought one of the most influential of such platforms, Twitter, with the pledge to restore free speech. An apparent repudiation of what is not so much about managing content as it is the suppression of information and opinion politically intolerable to radical leftists like Obama. Time will tell whether these were coincidental developments or, for that matter, whether Mr. Musk will really enable freedom of expression on Twitter. What is clear already is that the fight for that fundamental liberty has never been more necessary, and the emergence of a formidable man professing to be its champion more welcome. This is Frank Gaffney. We're back, and we're continuing a very important, very timely conversation with one of the leading forces in our Committee on the Present Danger, China, and I think one of the country's preeminent experts on the mortal threat we face from that quarter, the Chinese Communist Party. Dr. Bradley Thayer is his name. He is the author of How China Sees the World, Han Centrism, and the Balance of Power in International Relations. Brad, one of the things that the Han supremacists in Beijing are clearly focused on is what you've described as our Western border. And I think if Americans think of that at all, they probably think of, well, maybe California and the Pacific Northwest. You've pointed out that actually our border is much further removed from the continental United States and much closer to China. Walk us through that and the threats that you now see arising from this, growing kinetic warfare capability of China, as well as its other unrestricted warfare elements.
Thank you, Frank. Yes, we recognize that our borders are under threat. The southern border rightfully receives attention. It should receive more, of course, but we're also under a different type of threat on our western border, particularly to Guam, a United States territory. We're obligated clearly to defend it. It's a very important base for the Navy, for the Air Force, and for other military and other assets that the United States has. It's under direct threat, first from the development of Chinese missiles, medium, intermediate range missiles, of course, Chinese strategic capabilities, the great growth in their cruise missile capabilities, and even new developments, including essentially an air-launched ballistic missile. Equally importantly, Frank, the Chinese are outflanking Guam through their expansion in Melanesia and Polynesia. So if we think mentally of a map of the Pacific, we can see to the south of Guam and to the southwest of Guam, Chinese influence is expanding. Kiribati, Tonga, as you've noted many times, of course, the Solomon Islands rightfully is receiving significant attention due to the Chinese agreement with that country.
Albeit belatedly so.
Indeed. We have a western border, and it's under threat, not from migrants crossing the border, but from our enemy, the People's Republic of China, which is threatening, of course, Guam, Hawaii, Alaska, indeed the United States in toto, through its strategic capabilities and other mechanisms. But Guam is on the front line, and it's poorly defended from Chinese missile capabilities, whether they're hypersonic cruise missiles or ballistic missile capabilities. It's a very valuable asset, which if we were to lose it in any type of conflict, it would greatly complicate our ability to reassure our allies, to continue our extended deterrent, and to defeat the Chinese Communist Party.
Yeah. And losing it might not involve its actual seizure by the Chinese, though that's something that probably can't be ruled out, but simply its neutralization by this accumulated capability. And you mentioned hypersonic missiles, and now apparently a new generation of air-launched ballistic missiles capable of precision anti-ship as well as anti-island or fixed target attacks. And when you think about this, Brad, together with this sort of island hopping campaign, to use a term that was coined for MacArthur's liberation of the Pacific in World War II, the Chinese are moving inexorably, it seems, not just into and through the first island chain, but are now very much obtaining a capability to neutralize, as we said, the second island chain. And again, from a strategic point of view, for the geographically challenged among us, why is that so important, both to, you know, Hawaii, among other places, and to our interests in the Pacific more generally?
Indeed, to Alaska, Hawaii, other U.S. territories. But very importantly, Frank, as you well know from your time in the Pentagon, the lines of communication, sea lines of communication, air lines of communication to Japan, to Korea, to Taiwan, to the Philippines, New Zealand, and Australia are threatened by the Chinese outflanking of Guam and their growing influence in Polynesia and Melanesia.
And let me just interrupt for a second, because sea lines of communication is a term of art, I think, in the military in particular. It's not just about, you know, being able to talk to people. It's about actually conducting commercial relations. It's about the transit of waters or access to what's underneath them or the air overseas. But also, you know, very much vital to our interests that we have those kinds of SLOCs, as they're called, inviolable. But that's not the case any longer, it seems, and ever less so with the Chinese buildup. Is that right?
Indeed, we're making the assumption that the SLOCs are not going to be negatively affected. The Chinese aren't going to be able to cut them. What we're witnessing now is the Chinese, again, this is the flowering of their strategy. They've planned this for a long time, and now it's coming to pass, are going to be able to interdict our ability to resupply our forces, our allies, and to project power in the Indo-Pacific. So it's a way of, as they're doing in space, as they're doing in other areas, it's a way of targeting us to destroy our ability to project power and to damage and ultimately, if it comes to it, to destroy the United States in any type of conflict. So it's a very worrisome development that does not receive the attention that it warrants as these events are developing.
Let me ask you quickly about one other piece of this, Brad, and we talk about it with you and others in this program incessantly, because I think it's absolutely of paramount importance that we understand not only what you've just said about the comprehensiveness of the Chinese threat and its buildup, military and otherwise, but also the extent to which we are actually enabling it by investing in Chinese corporations, some of them actually directly engaged in the acquisition for the People's Liberation Army of weapon systems of the kind that you're talking about are likely to be used against us. And I want just very quickly to ask you about specifically a problem that has just emerged, which is an effort being made by something called the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board, with its principal manager, Larry Fink of BlackRock, to get federal government employees, past and present, to have their personal retirement savings invested in some of these Chinese companies. Just very quickly, we got a minute. How serious a mistake would that be? And more generally, how important is it that we stop underwriting our enemy, Brad?
It's a profound mistake. It is a strategic error of the first order that the United States is allowing and funding the a Chinese Communist Party and the Chinese military. The word foolish, the word myopic, they simply don't begin to describe the depths of this mistake. And it needs to be reversed, Frank, as we're attempting to do, of course, and others are as well. But it's a profound mistake. And it calls into question many other issues. So the quality of our strategic leadership, the interest of Wall Street in supporting the rise and the growth of China, even though it's detrimental to us. So at a time when our western border is threatened by Chinese military capabilities, our southern border is threatened by China through fentanyl, precursors of chemicals, other counterfeit goods, as well as narcotics that the Chinese are sending through the southern border.
They're money laundering for the cartels, among other things. And Brett, these are several points that I'm thrilled that you've mentioned, because we're going to talk more about them with our next guest, Buck Revell, a former FBI agent and leader. I thank you for your time today, my friend. Come back to us again with updates very soon, if you would. Next up, Buck Revell on all of this and more, straight ahead.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back. It is a delight to say, joined by one of the men I've come to admire most in the world. His name is Buck Revell, Oliver Buck Revell. He is a longtime professional in the public sector, working initially for the United States Marine Corps for 5 years, serving in uniform, and then for about 30 years as an agent and then as a senior executive of the Federal Bureau of Investigations. He is these days a principal of the Revell Group and a contributor to the public policy debate in a number of different forums. And I'm so pleased one of them is this, Securing America. Buck, welcome back. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Good to be back, Frank.
I want to start by asking you, when we first met, Buck, I think you were working the domestic terrorism problem, focused primarily on the prospect that jihadists were in this country and might engage in acts of terrorism against us. These days, your old outfit, the FBI, is focused on a domestic terrorist threat, but it seems principally to be looking at white supremacists and other extremists of a sort of racist character. At least that's what we're being told we're awash with. Do you regard that as a serious threat to our country and deserving of seemingly the principal, if not exclusive, focus of the FBI's domestic front?
Well, it has never been the greatest terrorist threat to the United States. There is a threat. I mean, we go back to the Ku Klux Klan and various right-wing groups that were active, but they've never been a threat to take over the United States. They certainly could cause substantial damage, but nothing like a 9/11. The closest we had to that was Timothy McVeigh and the Oklahoma City bombing. The only way they can support that is by the number of events, and a lot of these events are one person, one off. They're not representing organizational attacks. The jihadists are representing a total across the board. Now, obviously, a lot of people that belong to that particular religion are not jihadists, but unfortunately, the ones that are fairly tightly controlled and influenced, and they continue to represent the most significant threat. I don't care what they're piping out of, you know, the nonsense in Washington. When I talk to the agents in the field, including senior people, they still say, well, obviously our greatest threat is the Islamic. Now, we're getting more and more threats coming across the border from various elements, including Russians, Chinese, and Iranians. The Iranian threat has never been higher, and yet it's always been since the fall of the Shah. It has been a significant challenge to us in America.
Let me ask you specifically about one that we've been told was actually the greatest threat. Timothy McVeigh was a piker compared to the insurrection that was unleashed on the Capitol. It has apparently spawned the largest investigation in the history of the FBI. Do you regard that as, first of all, an insurrection, but second of all, as this monstrous internal threat?
No, it was a absolutely terrible circumstance, and it needed to be dealt with immediately. It should have not have been allowed to get out of hand. And those who were inside the Capitol who committed other crimes need to be prosecuted. But it certainly was never a threat to take over the United States. I realize people inside the building at the time were traumatized by it, they should have had better security and protection. But it is not a threat to take over the United States by any means.
Overthrow the government, for example. Yeah. And you know, one of the questions that remains, and I don't know that the FBI is studying it, or for that matter, this January 6th committee, Buck, is why was the security so lax? Why was the president's suggestion that they bring in National Guard and man up for this? Or even have it at the steady, normal business level of security, to say nothing of heightened.
I'm looking forward to seeing the bottom line on that, because somewhere along the line, somebody certainly dropped the ball.
Indeed. And I don't think it was an accident, comrade, but that's my take.
Well, that remains to be seen, but it needs to be determined exactly what happened, why it happened, and how to prevent it in the future, not just at the Capitol building, but at any government facility. You know, and I'm also the attacks against the government facilities across the country after, you know, the situation in Minneapolis. That I think that set a precedent that we're still living with. When people go that far, they've got to be brought to justice. I don't care which side of the political spectrum they fall on.
Amen. And the fact that they haven't been prosecuted, whether it set a precedent or simply emboldened the bad guys. Yeah, some have. Not nearly enough. Yeah, amen. Buck, let me turn to a slightly different enemy within problem, and that is, as you know, having spent your life inside the Bureau working, among other things, against state actors, the Russians, notably the Soviets before them, the Chinese. One of the things that we're facing is a concerted effort. There's more and more evidence of it. A friend of ours, Peter Schweitzer, has written an entire book about it, Red-Handed, in which he talks about how, you know, American elites are helping the Chinese win. Talk a little bit about the problem of elite capture in the United States at the hands of the Chinese Communist Party, and the extent to which it really represents a serious, well, counterintelligence problem for starters, but also a domestic security threat as well.
Well, the Chinese are following the model that the Soviet Union set up, going after penetration through the universities. And they have really honed that weapon to the greatest extent. I doubt if there's any significant university in the United States that doesn't have some funding coming through some front from the Chinese.
To say nothing, just the students themselves, the substantial sums that they're transferring in.
Yeah. I don't want to see every Chinese student looked at as a spy, but you need to be alert that their government, if they have family back home, can bring tremendous pressure, even if they're not doing it, you know, of their own volition, and many are. You go way back and remember Larry Wu Tai-Chin, you know, became a translator during the Korean War, came over and worked for the CIA, and stayed in the agency actively for 30 years, and was never detected until he was retiring. The Chinese are willing to give their assets the open road to do what they think they can do and when they think they can do it, not nearly as demanding as the KGB was, or Russian Soviet intelligence. And they say, you know, get us what you can when you can. And it turned out very well for them. I mean, you know, we've had...
Buck, let me just ask you, because we're going to run out of time before we run out of things to talk to you about, but just specifically, again, as a national security professional of long standing and highly, you know, decorated accomplishment, should we be worried that if you look at the Hunter Biden's laptop, the commander in chief of the United States appears to be among those who have been deeply compromised by these Chinese influence operations and other acts of penetration?
We should know exactly what went on between Hunter Biden, the inner circle, and before he was president, the president. I don't think it's continued, but to him, although he hasn't ostracized and put Hunter outside of his inner circle. You know, there's more there than, you know, he shouldn't be allowed near government. I don't care what the president thinks about it being a son. If it was my son, he'd be ostracized, you know. And frankly, I think they're, from what I have seen, there certainly is a lot there that needs to be fully disclosed and, if possible, prosecuted. Being son of the president doesn't make you immune from prosecution. Yeah.
Well, and unfortunately, to the extent that the big guy himself is implicated in all of this, I would think that that would not make him immune either, for that matter.
If you had evidence, but right now it's a matter of comment and hearsay. And sometimes people will say things to give themselves more gravitas than they might have, but we don't know.
Well, it does need to be very carefully examined, Buck. And I think that what we're increasingly seeing from the laptop is evidence that, you know, actual influence in exchange for compensation of various kinds was undertaken. Lastly, and very quickly, Buck, I've only got about a minute left. We're going to talk with Ben Berquam about the border insecurity. I know you're very engaged on that issue, including with your state government officials down there in Texas. Your thoughts on the character of what has been called an invasion and the security threat that it poses?
I'm not political, but let me say this. If we have a change in government at the legislative level in November, one of the first orders of business ought to be a consideration of impeaching the governor or the president for failure to carry out his duties to protect the United States and its citizens. It is absolutely egregious and needs to be dealt with in the most positive way, because it's got to stop, and he or his administration is not willing to do it.
We have to leave it at that, Buck. Article 2 of the impeachment may be the Chinese caper, but I think you're right. Article 1 is the border. Buck Revelle, thank you for your extremely important and distinguished service to our country over many years, and that you render these days at the Revelle Group and by visiting with folks like us. I hope you'll do so again very soon, sir. In the meantime, thank you. Stay well. You too. Ben Berquam's up next on the border right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The man who promised to fundamentally transform the United States of America is back at it. In an address at Stanford University last week, former President Barack Obama called for the government to regulate free speech. Despite describing himself as pretty close to a First Amendment absolutist, Mr. Obama outlined an approach whereby private sector social media's own efforts at what he euphemistically called content management would be regulated by governmental authorities so as to control the dissemination of, quote, disinformation, unquote. It's hard to overstate the menacing implications of such an arrangement for our constitutional republic. Obama characterized the exercise of free expression by a domestic political opponent as, quote, flooding the public square with raw sewage, unquote. Such an impetus for censorship is not a characteristic of a First Amendment absolutist, but someone absolutely determined to silence speech of which he does not approve. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. A very special welcome to a man I respect enormously, both for his reportorial daring do as well as his sheer courage in covering one of the most dangerous beats in the world today, and that is the border of the United States, both sides of it, for that matter. Ben Berquam is his name. He is a well-known featured reporter for Real America's Voice. We're very proud to have him both as a friend and as a colleague, and to catch up with him whenever we can in various garden spots of the universe. I gather you're in Arizona today. You were in the Darien Gap just yesterday, and I want to talk to you first about the Darien and what you saw there, Ben, and what is headed our way through it now.
Yeah, absolutely, Frank. It's always a pleasure to be with you, and it's you know, we cover both sides. This is an ongoing fight. And really, it's the, if not the most pivotal, at least one of the top three fights that we have in our country to determine whether or not we will remain a sovereign nation. That's why, you know, I focus so heavily on the U.S. side, but going to Panama, going down to the Darien Gap, you really, and really all of the borders. So what we just finished a week long tour down in the Darien Gap, and to see.
Remind us what that is. I know it's a feature of your reporting, but Ben, for this audience in particular, why is it such an important location in the migration routes north to the border here?
Well, it's basically for anyone coming up from South America, it's the entry point, you know, assuming they don't go on boats. Some people do take boats further around, but it's more difficult if you're out in the Pacific or even in the Gulf. And so most of the traffic that we're seeing that ends up at the Texas or Arizona or New Mexico or California borders all come through the Darien Gap. It's a 70, 80, 100 mile in some areas section of just dense, dangerous jungle. It basically is Panama's and the North America's border between North America and South America. There's no driving routes between there. So this has actually been a great thing for Panama for years. It's a natural border that they've used. There've been a lot of people that have tried to build a road or propose building a road, but thank God they haven't yet. And so it's kind of the last line of defense in protecting North America from South American invasion. Now,
and how hard is it to get through it, and how dangerous is that transit?
Well, it's been historically very dangerous, and it still is. It's one of the most dangerous jungles in the world. They have cougars and venomous snakes and some of the most rugged terrain, cliffs and weather, most violent weather that you find on the planet. And so those.
And some hostile natives too. Is that a factor?
And hostile natives. That's right. So we were actually down with the Imbara people. They're the indigenous people of that region. There's three tribes that basically control that area. And we had the blessing of the Imbara chief and his third in command. And so they were taking us around, but this is an area that, he's even admitted, you know, many of his people have been involved in the violence that you see down there, partly out of protection of their community and their property, and unfortunately, partly because of the criminality that comes with it. This is also a very high drug trafficking corridor. So the cartels have drugs going through. And so there's just, it's a dynamic, kinetic place.
And I think one of your colleagues with whom, as I understand it, you were touring the place, Michael Yon, who's talked to us from time to time as well, says that maybe one out of 10 people passing through there don't make it as a result of these various hazards. Is that about right?
Yeah, that's the estimate that he gives. And that's who I was actually down there with Michael Yon, amazing war correspondent, warrior, Green Beret, and now also focuses on the border as well. But yeah, that's his estimates, around 10% don't make it. And when you see the people coming out, you understand that that can be an accurate number. It is a very unpleasant place to be. Every single person that we've asked that's made it through has said they wouldn't recommend it anyone else to go through it. That's assuming they got through and they come out with festering wounds on their legs, and it's just a horrific place to be.
Yeah, they obviously are still coming, though. What was your sense of the size of the surge that is now moving through those jungle areas and heading towards our border?
Well, to go back to the question before, how dangerous is it? It really depends on the route that you take. There are routes that can take you up to 2 weeks to get through. There is now a route that you can get through in 2 days. And what we just found out in this trip is that in Colombia, the cartels down there, the smugglers are actually selling routes. So the more that you pay, the shorter the route you get. The less you pay, the longer the route you get. So your chances of dying are exponentially higher if you can't pay for the better routes. But what we're seeing is a massive influx into that area, and mostly through the shorter routes. So most of the people that we see coming through either can afford to pay it, or are using themselves to pay the cartels. That means they're smuggling something, or they're going to be indebted to the cartels once they get up here. And these are, just so people understand, it's not Mexican cartels in the Darien Gap. There are different, you have Colombian cartels that they have to go through. So every section either has criminal organizations, MS-13, MS-18, or cartels, or some sort of criminal element that you have to pass through to get to that next spot. The worst part about what I saw this entire week I was down there was it's a difficult place to get through. But what we're doing, and we actually were there the same days that Secretary Mayorkas and Blinken were there. We were actually staying right next to the camp that Secretary Mayorkas flew into and then flew out of, and then said he had been at the Darien Gap. But the worst part is that we're finding out now, rather than helping to slow it down, this new controlled flow idea that the White House and Washington, D.C. are pushing, is basically just making it streamlined. So as the people come in, it used to be they would be stuck there for, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 days, up to 2 weeks sometimes, before they would be able to cross through. Panama was trying to stop it, trying to push them back. Now, basically, what the U.S. government has done is paid Panama off to push people through. So instead of slowing it down, which was a natural prevention mechanism, the slower this takes people to get from point A to point B through each country, you know, if it takes you 2 months to get there, you start messaging back home and say, hey, it's probably not worth it. If you can get from your home country to the United States within a week or 2 weeks, it's much more enticing to come. And that's exactly what Washington, D.C. is doing. They have opened the floodgates, and we were seeing it. It was a well-tuned machine. They come into the jungle, they get out of the jungle, they get on boats, they go down, they get in the camp, and within 24 hours, they're on to Costa Rica. And Costa Rica has the same controlled flow mechanism set up as well.
So we're watching the tractor beam that the Biden administration has created to encourage people to come, and now to actually facilitate their travel here, operating at a high tempo. We have to take a quick break for just a second. We'll be right back with much more with Ben Berquam, and we'll talk about a judge's order saying you can't lift Title 42, what that might mean for all of us, right after this. We're back, and we're visiting with Ben Berquam, a courageous, intrepid, and extremely competent reporter covering the beat that is arguably one of the most dangerous in the world today, namely along the border. He's these days, we find him in Arizona, and it's hazardous on this side of the border too. And maybe we can talk a little bit about that, Ben. But before we do, you were describing the effects of the Biden administration's policies bringing many, many thousands of people here now, I guess, on a daily basis, and letting them into the country, dispersing them all over. A federal judge has, however, interposed a temporary injunction, as I understand it, on the removal of one of the tools that the previous administration, and to some extent even this one, has used to try to stem that slow, or at least slow down that that rising tide, that invasion that you've been covering. What do we make of that ruling? Is it likely to be still in force on the 23rd of May, when I gather it's supposed to be lifted by the administration?
Well, I can't say whether or not it will or won't. I'm guessing the Biden and Washington, D.C., the administration are going to do everything they can to lift it. They're being pushed by the fringe radical leftist part of the party. And that's really the driving force of the Democratic Party right now. These are the people that go around chanting no borders, no walls, no USA at all. They don't believe America has the right to have sovereignty. That is the force that is behind Joe Biden and all of his decisions related to the border right now. Whether or not Title 42 goes away or not, the damage has already been done. What we're seeing coming up is going to be it's historic. It's unprecedented. And I'll just tell you, America's not ready for it. I was interviewing folks down. Like you said, I was in the Darien Gap yesterday. They were just interviewing folks down in the Darien Gap. And the crazy thing is these people are coming from all over the world. It's not just, you think, Central America and Mexico and South America. We were talking to people that had flown in from Somalia and from Kazakhstan and Afghanistan and Pakistan and Bangladesh and India and even Nepal. The word has already spread. America is free for the taking if you can get there. So whether or not Title 42 goes away, it's really at this point irrelevant. The floodgates are open. As long as they're able to stay once they get here, as long as the perception is that they have a chance of staying once they get here, then they're going to continue to flood in. And especially as we make it easier for them to do that. That basically we've rolled out the red carpet and said, just come on in with this controlled flow mechanism.
Yeah, I listened appalled to a U.S. representative from California by the name of Tony Cardenas this morning on NPR, talking about how this is all going to be fine as long as we just give them the vaccine when they come across the border. Public health is a serious problem, of course, and will be with or without the vaccines, but that's only one aspect of the dangers that are associated with this, not least of which, as you've mentioned, a number of countries that wish us.
Right. Well, there are many. We could go on a whole hour long about this subject alone. It's not just COVID. So the small little village there that I was with, the Imbara people, they said malaria now, they believe it's coming from Africa. It's making a resurgence. They're getting 18 to 20 cases per day out of this small camp of just a couple hundred people. That's out of the illegals that are coming through. They're just flooding through. So we've created a pandemic of malaria now for their community. We also have yellow fever, dengue fever, Zika virus, and some drug-resistant tuberculosis. There are all kinds of other diseases that are coming through this, not to mention the countries. Yes, not to mention the countries that hate us.
Yeah, hazards for our border patrol, to say nothing of the rest of the country as well. We're going to run out of time before we run out of things to talk with you about. I did just want to note that in the course of the day today, the Supreme Court of the United States heard the case for restoring the policy of keeping these people on the Mexican side of the border while their applications for amnesty are processed. Ben, how important is it that we get that remain in Mexico policy reinstated?
Well, it's probably the most important policy that President Trump put into effect, but the policy only works if you have a lever against Mexico imposed on it as well. And that's what President Trump did. He imposed a 5% tariff and then came back and said, well, we won't impose that tariff if you allow us to do this remain in Mexico policy. That was how he was able to get Mexico to come along with it. The remain in Mexico policy only works if Mexico allows it to work. And everything Joe Biden and the Democrats are doing right now, they're saying, because they've already been ordered to reinstate it. And they're saying that they've reinstated it. But basically, the catch-22 on it is they're saying, oh, we're reinstating it. We're sending it back to Mexico. Mexico's saying they don't want them. And so now we're stuck with them. And so that they have to. You have to have the will to make it work. And they just simply don't have the will.
The will to make it work and the leverage to infect it, if you do have the will. I wanted to talk to you, and we're going to have you back very, very soon, Ben, to get into this cartel business. One just quick question. States have the authority to defend themselves against invasion if the federal government fails to do that. There's some talk about state guards or state defense forces being stood up and empowered for this mission. Just 15 seconds. Good idea. Necessary.
It's the last defense. It has to happen or else our country's gone. That's actually why I'm down here in Arizona meeting with Carrie Lake tomorrow. That is what has to happen. States have to take their sovereignty back if the federal government won't do it.
Amen. Carrie Lake running for governor down there. Thank you so much for your time today, Ben Berquam. Godspeed, my friend, in this important work you do. There's really nobody who is on the beat quite like you are, and we appreciate the chance to visit with you from time to time and to watch you on Real America's Voice the rest of the time. I know you'll keep up that good work and carry on. Godspeed again. And I want to say thanks to the rest of you for joining us for this edition of Securing America. I hope you feel better equipped to help us in doing just that. It's a vital mission for reasons that you've heard about in this program and every other one. So please stay tuned and also check out our web resource, securingamerica.tv. And then, as I'm fond of saying, I hope you'll go forth and multiply.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.